This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 47 for Monday, January 12th, 2009, Micro Formats. This week we have an interview on Micro Formats. Our special guest is Pete Perdell. Before we actually dive into the topic, we talked to Pete about Creative Commons and how he's been blogging for more than 11 years. Let's listen in. Hi, this is Larry Clark, and I'm recording another Thirsty Developer episode on location here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm here with Pete. Pete, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Pete Perdell. I am a VP of Interactive Media at Z2 Marketing out in Pewaukee, Wisconsin.
And everybody who listens to The Thirsty Developer, who's a regular subscriber, has actually heard your work from episode one of the show.
Sure.
You are actually the artist who created both the intro and the outro music that we use on the show.
Yeah. Besides my fancy title, I'm kind of hobbyist, do everything media creator. So I make music, take photos, do some video stuff, all sorts of online hijinks, microblogging, and that sort of stuff. So yeah.
And one of the things I want to do is like point people to you've got those songs. It's Backing In and Large Deposits are the names of the two songs.
Yeah.
I'll actually put a link to the full MP3 because mm-hmm. one of the things that we do when we publish The Thirsty Developer is we publish it in mono. So you've lost a lot of the fidelity there, you know, because your songs were originally in stereo. And we also downsample it to make the file size a little smaller. Mm-hmm. So I'll point people to that and they could check it out. But you also, it's kind of interesting. You do an album every year now. And we're coming up on the second album, right?
I've done one last year. In February, there's a thing called the RPM Challenge, RPM being record production month, where you take 28 days, or it was 29 in a leap year, to record an entire album, which should be, I think they put it at either 10 songs or 35 minutes of music. So last year, I did record 10 songs, which was about 25 minutes of music. And this year, it's almost February, so I'll be doing it again. And I'm still unsure. I have a couple ideas as to what I want to do, but I'm so far unsure, so I don't know until it's done what it's going to be.
And in the show notes, we'll point people to last year's album. I actually have it on my, you know, my portable audio device that I carry around. I actually have that album still on there. And when I'm hitting shuffle, occasionally it pops up, and I'm like, who is this? I was like, oh, that's Pete's stuff, you know? And most of your stuff is instrumentals, and you mix in a few things every once in a while, though, right?
Yeah, I'm traditionally a bass player mainly. I played around on guitar a lot. I play a little bit of drums, which I just brought my drums into the studio today. But who knows, there might be some vocals on this one. I throw in some keyboards now and then, not that I can really play them. But it's really just to have fun, experiment, be creative, and I actually release the stuff under a Creative Commons license, so you're welcome to share it with your friends and whatnot.
Do you want to take a minute to talk about Creative Commons licenses? Because I'll tell you our story. When we were looking for theme music for The Thirsty Developer, mm-hmm. we had a healthy debate going back and forth about there's a rule that you can use like up to 39 seconds of any commercially available song under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, if you go to Amazon.com, you can listen to a snippet of a song before you buy it.
Yeah,
and same thing
right.
with iTunes right. and all the music stores, right? But, you know, they fall under the ability to use that license because they're trying to sell you that
right.
music.
Yeah.
You know, I said, guys, there's a better way to end the debate. Let's use some Creative Commons music, you know, where the artist has already given us permission to
right.
do that.
Yeah. Personally, I've been, you know, interested in kind of art, creativity, design, you know, since I was a kid. I do drawings and whatnot. And as I got into high school, I started publishing a zine, which is, you know, sort of a fanzine magazine kind of thing. You know, if I made 20 copies of it on a school copy, I was lucky. And I'd try to sell them for like a quarter. And that was just because it cost me, you know, whatever amount to make it. So throughout the years, I'd, you know, make these zines and either try to give them away or, you know, charge very little for them. if I knew somebody at a copy shop who could make me, you know, a couple hundred copies, then I would give them away or say, you know, it's free. If you want to give me a donation, that's fine. So I guess that's kind of the start of my wanting to just give away my work and share it with others. And that's kind of a big thing of Creative Commons. It's not just giving things away for free, but just giving things away for people to use. Even if you do, you know, there's a charge for it. So I guess when Creative Commons started, and I'm trying to think how many years it's been now. It's probably been 4, 5, 6 years. I'm not sure how long.
I think it was early 2000, 2001, you know.
Yeah, didn't they just have like their, was it the 6th birthday? I can't remember which birthday it was, but I think they just had, you know, an anniversary or whatever. So when that came along, you know, I kind of read the concept of it and I really liked it. Cause, you know, I've been publishing online for, you know, 10, 11 years now. And I really like the idea of just, you know, creating things and kind of giving a pre-permission to people on how they can use it. You know, Flickr's been around since, I think, 2004 or something.
Yep.
And, you know, I love putting my photos on there, and I loved seeing other people's photos on there. But, you know, at the time, you're worried, like, well, can I download this? Can I use this as a wallpaper? Can I print this? And with things like all rights reserved, you know, you either might have to do something like track down that person or send them an email and say, hey, can I use your photo? And they might never be online again. You might never know. You might not be able to ever find them. So I really like the fact that, you know, I can publish photos and whatever else as Creative Commons, and it kind of gives people pre-permission to use those. You know, if they want to print them out, put them on their wall, use them as a desktop background, whatever, that's a great thing. So one of the reasons I find this useful is a few months back I had an idea for a project where I wanted to find photos on Flickr that were signs that had the name Pete in them. So I found one for like a barbershop, one for like a bar, and I wanted to get a bunch of these and get printouts of them. And a bunch of them were all rights reserved. So, you know, I took the trouble to, like, you know, email these people and make sure it was cool that I used it. And, you know, most of them would get back to me in some timely manner saying, like, oh, yeah, hey, that's great. You're not selling it or anything, right?
And I think most people, when you ask them to use their work like that, you know, they're flattered, you know, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And they're willing to, as long as you're not trying to make $1 million off of it, they're willing to let you use it.
Right.
And Creative Commons is just a way to kind of preempt that whole trying to track me down, find me. I registered with a Yahoo or a Hotmail account that I don't check anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, and I try really hard to follow the licenses that people use. And if they've got all rights reserved, I'm not just going to grab it and print it and do something with it, you know, because I don't think that's within my rights. So I try to respect other artists who choose a license or for whatever reason, because I want people to follow my license, you know, adhere to what I like. So a few years back, I think 2005, when I was doing a lot of video, I got an email, and I was actually out of the state at the time, and this is, I don't really have a portable email device at the time in 2005. So I got back from a trip, I was gone for a few days, I got an email from a PBS television station wanting to use one of my videos.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was great. And it was actually a Creative Commons license to it, but because they didn't know what that meant, you know, they kind of sent me this email saying, oh, we'd like to use your video and show it, for a private event we're holding. And they said they were really kind of confused at the time. They said, well, we're not charging to get into the event, so we're not charging people to see your work, but it is a private event only for the station, so is that okay? And I kind of wrote back and said, oh, yeah, you know, it's totally fine. You know, I kind of explained the license a bit and said, you know, you can actually use this if it's unclear. You know, it's great to follow up. But, you know, so I think just people learning more about licenses and how they work is a good thing, so people realize how they can use different work.
Yeah, and you're kind of – I hate to throw a title on you, but I think one of the many titles I think you carry is a Creative Commons evangelist, because you spend a lot of time, you know, working with the community folks to get them to understand Creative Commons.
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what we've done, like for Web 4 and 4, things at Bucketworks is, you know, we've sometimes said this is a Creative Commons zone. You know, if you're there taking pictures of a Web 4 and 4 meeting, well, we want those to fall under a Creative Commons license because, we want to be able to use those to promote the group, and we don't want to track down some guy who took photos, put 20 of them on Flickr that are great shots, and say, hey, we'd really like permission to use this for our group. It's like, it's a give and take thing. You know, you've got shots of our group. We'd like to share these with others and make them available. So the funny story I have about, Gabe Wollenberg, also known as Hey Gabe, is, this is kind of the story of how we've met I think it was 2004, maybe 2005. he put a photo on Flickr out in Oconomowoc of Fowler Lake, and I saw this photo online. I said, "Oh, it's a pretty nice photo." And I actually saw the exact same photo on the newspaper website in town.
Right.
I got a little worried, and I'm like, I think the newspaper might be stealing photos from Flickr.
Yeah.
And the photo on Flickr was a Creative Commons photo. So I'm like, they took this guy's photo and didn't give him credit.
Right.
So I emailed the paper, and I complained about that. And I said, it looks like you may have taken this photo from Flickr and not given proper permission. You didn't give attribution on the photo. So I got this email back from a guy saying basically, I'm the photographer on the photo, and I sort of dual license it, so I made it available on Flickr under the Creative Commons license, but I also licensed it to the newspaper. So I was okay with that, and I wrote back, and I'm like, oh, okay, great, that's good to know. And I found out later that was Gabe, basically.
Right.
And Gabe's story was, he's like, you kind of freaked me out because I didn't know what to do. I get this email saying I violated a license. And so I just kind of did some research and I got back to you, and hopefully I was just hoping you would buy it. And I'm like, yeah. So that's kind of the way Gabe and I met, which is attributes to Creative Commons.
Gabe's a really good guy. And he's one of the guys I think I want to have on the show eventually. You mentioned Web 414. Mike Rohde was on the show, four or five episodes ago. And we talked about the group there. It's independent, web designer, developer group, mm-hmm. basically anybody interested in the web can come by.
Yeah.
And it's a very loose group. It doesn't have affiliations to any companies or anything like that.
Right.
Probably Bucketworks is the biggest affiliation, which is the place that we meet.
Our venue sponsor, as I should say. They let us meet there and we do our best to help them out too. So.
Yeah. So definitely want to, talk about microformats in a minute, but you also mentioned, in your conversation about Creative Commons there, and I think Creative Commons is a good conversation that every web developer, needs to know about.
Yeah.
We've all done a right-click view source, probably grabbed things we shouldn't have, as long as we respect the license, no matter what it is, and we tell people, that there's better ways of sharing stuff. I think
right.
that's great. Thirsty Developer is a Creative Commons license. Every episode we've ever done.
That's great.
I'm looking at modifying the license because what I'd love to be able to do is have people put a good backbeat to it, during the interview. But, I don't quite know how to do the, no derivatives thing in such a way that they couldn't like mess with our words,
Right.
It's something we ought to think about.
Yeah. Have you listened to The Evil Genius Chronicles by Dave Slusher?
No, I should check that out though, right?
Yeah, he's been doing it since 2004. He's one of the old timers. But what he'll do is he basically, his show, it'll be under, I think, whatever Creative Commons license he has, but then he will make a distinction that, occasionally he'll get songs online from bands.
Right.
That have unclear licenses. So if a band has its own website and they make a song available for download and there's no license because a lot of bands just don't know about this yet, he'll kind of make a clear distinction saying, everything in the show created by me is Creative Commons. Any of the music is available under, whatever the band has done.
Right.
So he kind of separates it out, which, and those are kind of things I still have questions about in Creative Commons where you do kind of compile a thing and it's like you don't, they have different licenses. It's that whole license poisoning thing, like in software.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
A GPL license with this. How does the end result come out? So those are questions I still have about Creative Commons.
Yeah, I actually have that on my disclaimer on my blog is that everything that I've created on the blog is Creative Commons attribution.
Right.
But if I have a screenshot, which is clearly somebody else's copyright, that I think I'm using under fair use. I think I'm using it appropriately. That license still belongs to them.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to, try to do the right thing.
Right.
I think basically respect other people's work and hope that people respect yours.
So you mentioned you've been online 11 years, and you're like what I like to call a proto-blogger. that somebody's who's been blogging before everybody knew what blogging was.
Sure.
And you want to talk about that for a second before we get into microformats?
Yeah, and I owe most of it to Dave Weiner, of course. I started following Dave Weiner online probably in 1990, I want to say 3 or 4, back when his software was Userland Frontier, a scripting environment, which was available on the Mac. So I got into that because that's when I started to try to learn to program again. So I had his software and I downloaded it, and he had kind of a small community going around it, and he, built a community around his software, and this was, 1994 or 5, so this is years and years ago.
This is when we were all on dial-up.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So, yeah, it was dial-up, that's true. So I was really interested in the things he was doing, and he did a lot of interesting projects. He did the 24 Hours of Democracy, which was it was sort of a this web ring kind of thing where you would sign up on his site and submit the URL where you wrote this thing about like democracy and on the internet and freedom and stuff. And what he would do is send you a like a previous link and a next link for two of the people. So
right.
basically on your page you'd have this essay with a little, you know, previous and next. And as you hit it, you'd go to the next essay. So you could sit there clicking next all day long and reading all these essays that were on a similar topic. So that was one of his early projects. And I really liked that. And I was, like I said, I've always kind of been into publishing since I was in high school. So it just made sense to get into publishing in the online world. So I think it was probably, well, it was. It was 1996 when I started. I think he started his blog in April. And then, you know, he was kind of the first one doing this format of, you know, new updates and they're on the top and everything else kind of goes below it and you scroll through them. So, and that became the format known as the weblog, which we really didn't, you know, have a name for it at that time.
And we didn't have the great tools and
yeah.
that we do now. I mean,
right. And he was developing, this within his software, Usulin Frontier. So a lot of the early blogs used that because he had, kind of a little suite within that that could do this kind of automated publishing.
Yeah, and that turned into the whole Usulin, you know, content management type system later.
Yeah, so yeah. he started in like April, and then it probably took a while. I think like Cameron Barrett started CamWorld, I think in June, and then I showed up around August, I think I started it. So, you know, within 6 months or whatever. And my joke is always that I'm the second longest continually running updated blog or something because I think Cameron quit for quite a while and Dave is still at it. So
right.
I keep saying if Dave ever stops, I grab that title.
You're number one, yeah.
That's right.
So you've been blogging for 11 and a half years.
Yeah. Since August. I think it was August 5th, 1996, which is actually my daughter's birthday. So that's kind of a nice...
So last year when you did your 10th anniversary piece,
yeah.
I actually, you know, and you talked about, and there is a real distinction between there were people blogging at the same time as you that gave up long ago.
Yeah.
You can't find their blogs.
Right.
You know, yours is literally every post you've ever done, you can still track back to.
You should still be able to link. Yeah.
I went back to your first posts, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny. I was like, oh no, man, Pete's not only one of the first bloggers. I think he's the first micro blogger. Cause I think the oldest page, the oldest 10 entries that you had right. on there were all like one line things that were happening to you. And I was like, he invented yeah. Twitter.
Did you? No, Eli, you weren't at, you missed Barcamp. Milwaukee 3, right?
Yes, I missed it 2 years in a row.
I actually I did a talk on microblogging,
right.
And I showed a few of my posts from 1996. I said, this, you know, so this isn't exactly a microblog. I said, these are blog posts from 1996. And it was like that a lot in the beginning when people were blogging, just kind of figuring out, like, you know, hey, check this out with a link or just, you know, random short thoughts of the day. It was really kind of feeling around into like what is this new publishing thing we have?
Right.
Where, yeah, I think before that, if some of us in the web world back then, you know, our publishing for, you know, the companies we worked for was here's a press release, get it online.
Right.
You know, there was a page with a list of titles and you clicked and read a whole press release or probably didn't read the press release. And that was kind of publishing at the time. And so it was great to see these people just kind of throwing things out there and doing random whatever.
I always think one of my jokes, you know, when I'm giving presentations, because my presentations pretty much just are a bunch of jokes,
because
I don't know what I'm doing from a technology right. standpoint anymore. But you know, is that you know, we can learn a lot about technology these days from Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the Borg. I mean, that's what viruses were, right?
Yeah.
And there was, you know, the Borg fleet. You know, that's the zombie bots that we've got yeah. running around the internet.
Scotty was the first hacker, I think.
Scotty was the first hacker, and of course, Captain Kirk was the first blogger.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
The fact that it takes place 300 years in the future, is he the first blogger or the last blogger?
Definitely.
But let's dive into microformats. And
yeah.
I think that you're an interesting guy and we could probably talk about all this stuff, you know, all day long. One of the things is that you're not really the classic developer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've come at this from the creative side, you know,
yeah.
you know, the design side, the look and feel. But you know, obviously there's a point where the pretty logo has got to stop and something's got to actually work and be interactive
yeah.
on the web.
Yeah.
And you call yourself a web designer, web developer, hacker, many things or something like that.
Yeah. I've been around, yeah, my background is really graphic design, so I kind of come from the visual world, but I've always leaned more towards the technical end of things.
Right.
So, yeah, I've never called myself a programmer, really. I hack on code. I don't really call myself, like, a visual designer because I don't just do that kind of stuff. I really don't do much of that anymore. So I'm kind of this weird place in the middle where I really love technology but like to apply it and have it look good, too. So
right. So one of the – you're like the first guy I ever heard mention the term microformats.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. And microformats is interesting because it is that – you know, look and feel plus program technology right. side of things. It's a good mixture of the two. But
yeah.
just tell us what your definition of microformats is.
Microformats, I think, are a way to, you know, mark up text so that it can be used not only by humans but by machines and processed and made into useful data and not just, you know, big alphabet soup of characters.
Yeah, and it's interesting that we're all tired of the buzzword Web 2.0.
Yeah.
And people talked about, you know, web. As soon as we labeled something Web 2.0, of course, people had to start saying, what's Web 3.0?
Yeah.
And people talk about the semantic web. And
right.
so much of the web now is, you know, for the, you know, person to computer experience, right? Mm-hmm. So when I go to Yahoo, it's not meant to be consumed by, you know, another computer program.
Right.
HTML, the markup itself, the JavaScript language and all that, you know, is meant for me to consume it with my eyes.
Right.
And microformats is a way for, you know, applications to consume that data in a way that makes sense to them. But
right.
more importantly, it also works well for the users.
Yeah.
So give us an example of a microformat.
Oh, microformat would be, you know, if you've got a contact page on your website, you may list your name, email address, phone number, and that's great. But, you know, when I go to Larry's website and I say, hey, here's Larry's phone number, I should put that in my address book. Should I need to copy that, you know, phone number and then go paste it into my address book? And then, oh, I want to copy his email as well and copy that. And it's basically a whole bunch of copy operations.
You're copying the individual elements of...
Yeah, you know, yeah. I have to copy all these things and paste them into whatever field in my address book. So, you know, why can't the computer be smart enough to say, you know, click a button and shove this right into my address book? Now, you can have that with things like a V card. But if you've seen a V card, they're not exactly readable. They're these just weird strings of characters. It's kind of like, you know, tab delimited file, as it were, where it's just a weird string of data. But microformats kind of let you build a web page and have it formatted nicely so that a human can look at it and it's very readable and you can have labels like phone and email. But still the underlying code is formatted in a way that it can simply map into the fields of your address book.
So. Yeah, and one of the weaknesses of, you know, V cards is you got to have a program on the one side that understands what a V card is.
Right.
Although it's much less of an issue now than it was a few years ago.
Yeah.
Because pretty much, you know, every operating system now, you know, the Linux, Mac, Windows, they all ship with something that kind of understands a V card if you click on it.
Right.
But the distinction there is the V card is separate than the, you know, if you wanted to have, you know, Larry Clarkin. You know, here's my email address, here's my phone number, and here's a V card that you can click on. It's
right.
two separate pieces of data.
Yeah, so when you change your phone number, oh, I got to change it here, I got to change it there. So,
and if your V card is generated off a database, you got to go find right. where that database is to change that.
Yeah, pretty much.
And
yeah.
and that's the isn't the canonical example when you're explaining to somebody who hasn't heard of a microformat, you know, the H card is the, you know, the canonical example of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
But the nice thing about microformats is it's not limited to just, it's not just a replacement for vCard.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's the guys working on microformats. It's kind of a, you know, get involved as much as you'd like kind of group. Cause it's basically a mailing list. You know, it's a bunch of guys online who hopefully are pretty darn smart. You know, they look at ways to apply microformats to pretty much anything. You know, and as metadata as well. So it's not just, you know, and that's the whole idea of microformats. So, you know, they're working on things like I've seen things say, you know, well, how can I have a recipe and apply that to a microformat? So, you know, this can go into some application that stores recipes. Obviously things like events and calendars are very big. Which again, like the address book thing, you want an easy way to pull calendar data into your own system for your own use, so that's a great way. And of course, the interchange between systems. So if you've got a website that publishes out your, you know, your band's calendar, and it's all marked up properly in microformats, you know, another site or system can pull that data in and drop it right into their calendar, and it can spread a little more.
And that's the real win versus vCalendar, iCalendar, you know,
right.
you know, vCard is that, you know, So if I'm creating a, you know, a recipe search site,
right?
And there are a couple of these on the internet, but a lot of them rely on screen scraping,
yeah,
you know, that they go out and they learn what Food Network site, you know, format is. And if Food Network changes it, it breaks their search, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this would be a way to say, you know, hey, any site that out there that has the recipe, micro format, I can pull that in.
Right.
And I don't have to worry about that breaking.
Yeah.
I think one of the other strengths is that, we've had good formats that have worked. Like RSS, I think, is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a classic example of a format that's really worked.
Right.
But we've extended the heck out of it. We've extended it to the point where we've lost, you know, sight of the purpose occasionally.
Right.
But it is a fixed format. Whereas microformats, you know, while there are the H card out there, that's the canonical example, and all the other ones are developing, they've really put together a taxonomy that, you know, as long as everybody agrees on it, you could fit anything in there.
Right.
And that's one of the real strengths of it.
Yeah.
We haven't yet mentioned the URL. So maybe we ought to do that so people can, you know, if they're listening to this on their computer, they can pull up
microformats.org.
Microformats.org. Yeah. And actually there's a much, much better than probably the explanation we're doing is there's a great Wikipedia article on it too.
Yeah.
That will give you the big background on this. But yeah. I think one of the strengths of any time that we come up with a new technology idea, you know, Pete and Larry put together the absolute, you know, great idea. Every time that we tell somebody, oh, by the way, you need a new platform to implement this, it means that it's years in coming, that it's going to be slow to adopt.
Right.
One of the real strengths of microformats is that if you're working on a system that's not microformats enabled, the degradation is instant, right? Because how do we implement these things?
Right. Yeah. And that kind of gets into, if you got time for stories, it's the time. I used to work for a business-to-business publishing company, and we built this thing called a buyer's guide is what we called it, which basically was a directory of companies in a specific industry. So, and we served, I think it was 14 different markets with about 70 publications. So the idea was each publication's website would have a buyer's guide, and because we had all this kind of manufacturer data, you know, just sitting in some FileMaker database. And they said, well, let's get this online. Let's get it so, you know, people can go in and choose categories and drill down and get info on these companies on our website. So we built a system, and at the time we kind of hired some consultants which did the programming, and I kind of managed these guys, and they weren't very forward-thinking at the time. And so my supervisor said, well, you know what, we need V cards in this thing. And I'm like, okay. So basically that was, you know, it was all database driven. So we were able to, you know, write the code for that and have a little link on the page for the V cards. And you click on that and it would download and you could put it in your address book or whatever. And that was probably, you know, this was probably 2001 or two when we were doing this. And at the time, it made sense, but as we kind of went on further and developed these buyer's guides more, at some point I said, well, you know, let me clean up these templates a little bit. And I said, because, you know, the code's a little messy. It's been a few years now. They probably just need a little rewrite. And they said, yeah, go ahead and do that. So what I did was, you know, microformats, when it comes down to it, it's basically CSS classes. So
yeah, that's the real kicker.
That is the real kicker.
Every browser will support a CSS class, even if I found, like, you know, IE3 or Netscape 3, it would ignore the class, right? So it supports it in the fact that, you know, it's going to degrade, you know, back to just HTML with some tags, some attributes I don't understand.
Right. So I was able to clean these templates, and I said, well, you know, I'm cleaning up. I'm just going to, you know, stick a few classes in here. So, you know, with the first one we did, you know, I put these templates up, and it was a handful, maybe 6-7 files. And, you know, all of a sudden we had 2,000 H cards online like that. And with each deployment of a buyer's guide, you know, there were another 2,000 online. And this was, you know, I don't know if it was mid-2000s. And at that point even, you know, people probably didn't realize what it was. And I didn't say to my supervisor, you know, I really think we should add microformats. So we should add H cards to all this because he's, you know, that takes an explanation.
Right.
So what I said was, I'd like to clean up the code a little and, you know, add some CSS into this. And they're like, oh, that's fine. So I said, you know, actually we have this formatted now. And I showed him on my machine. You can click on this little link. If you have this extension, it'll shoot over in your address. He says, oh, it's cool. Well, how do you do it? I'm like, well, it's just how it's marked up. You know, it's got a little CSS classes on it. And they're like, oh, that's cool. Great. And again, it wasn't me writing some big proposal saying, we need this, and them saying, well, I don't know. It's going to cost money. It was just, you know, adding some classes. So it was very simple to do. So each time they deployed another buyer's guide and put another 2,000 companies, it's more and more data online, in a micro format way that could be consumed. So that was, you know, like 2000, I want to say 4, 5, 6, I did that. And then, the first time I actually talked about microformats was in 2006 at a web design meetup in Milwaukee, and this was the precursor to Web 4.4. So I went to a meetup, and the first one I went to, they didn't really have any topics. They just kind of talked about whatever. So at the end of the meeting, I said, "Well, could I present next time? Could I do a demo?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, that'd be great." So it was on microformats, and this was 2006, and I kind of did a little slideshow thing with some demos and some code and some links, and explained it to people and tried to keep it really simple. And people seemed receptive to it. I don't know if it's because it was the first presentation they had, or they were actually interested.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you mentioned a couple things I want to follow up on. Yeah. Is you mentioned the extension, and yeah. there's an extension for Firefox. Right.
Yeah. A couple now.
That will. So. You know, yeah. There's probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
As with all things, right? So right. You know, somebody goes, "Well, you did it, but not quite the way I would have done it." You know. So there's a couple extensions you can get that'll actually pick up on any microformats that the extension's aware of.
Yeah.
They've just released one. We were talking about this before we started recording. Microsoft released a toolkit for microformats called Oomph. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, we're out of names that we can actually use. We're going to made up words now.
Right.
But you know, and it's got an extension, I think, for IE in there. So it'll do the same kind of functionality right there. You know, that's one way of using it, mm-hmm. you know, for the person. And it's a really neat experience that if you just have that extension running, when you hit a site that's got a microformat that it understands, mm-hmm. it just pops it up on the side.
Yeah.
And it looks really cool.
Right.
And you've extended the capabilities of the browser again without breaking anything.
Right. Yeah. I think and part of, you know, me wanting to do this years and years ago, getting microformats into place was, you know, it's that whole, like, why do we want to do this? Because, you know, well, no one can use it today, but maybe in a couple of years, it'll be useful. I mean, and it's the same thing with RSS. You know, when there were 10 blogs, you know, and they said, well, and one guy said, well, I'm going to put an RSS feed on mine. And it's like, why? What's going to use that?
Right.
Well, nothing yet, but, you know, and then 3 months later he wrote, you know, I'll write an aggregator. And then someone else says, yeah, I'm going to write one too. And so that's the thing of, like, you know, being able to kind of look forward and say, you know, this is interesting now. And there is this little obscure Firefox or Mozilla extension, whatever, that can use it. But I can see other people wanting to, you know, make things that use this too, and other tools are going to come along to consume these and use them. So
yeah, and I talk about this quite a bit when we talk about technology. Is that when we first launch it, you know, it's the idea of, you know, let's put a, you know, format out there.
Yeah,
the early adopters like yourself are doing it all with, you know, a text editor or Perl scripts,
right.
You know, a CGI interface. And then, you know, when the idea is fleshed out and it's like everybody agrees on the standard, because that always happens. You mentioned RSS. And
yeah.
The first thing that happened with RSS wasn't nine guys adopted it. The first thing was another another company took that acronym and rewrote it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's always some back and forth. And as long as those early adopters, you know, aren't really, you know, as long as they're flexible,
yeah.
it's going to work itself out.
Right.
You know, there's going to be a standard that emerges. Yeah. Then what happens, and when it really takes off, is when you see, you know, full platform vendors starting to adopt it.
Yeah.
Like blogs really took off, you know, not when the technology folks were reading each other's stuff,
right.
but when my mom could look on her browser and could see sure. the RSS, you know, thing light
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
That's when it really took off.
Right.
And when we see, you know, microformats not being an add-on that I got to know that I got to go get, mm-hmm. when we see it actually in tools, okay. you know, is when we'll really, you know, when it'll really take off.
Definitely. Yeah. So I did a presentation on microformats, and that was about 2006. At the first BarCamp Milwaukee, which was, I think, fall of 2006, I think I held a session on microformats, basically, and because I wanted to introduce more people to it. So there was kind of a big discussion during the whole discussion of, you know, and my whole idea was microformats, it's under the radar. You're a web designer or developer. You can just slip this in. It's CSS. It's easy. Well, the more hardcore programmer guys, you know, came out and said, no, this is all wrong. What you need is like an XML interface to this data that pulls it from the database, and it's formatted, you know, in XML that another system can read. I'm like, so what is this format? Well, you can just, you can do whatever you want. You can design one. I'm like, and the other guys are going to design the same thing. You're all going to, well, okay, when you're developing an XML interface, and I'm like, no. You guys, you're like 1,000 feet above us. What we're doing is adding CSS classes to data that exists.
Right.
I said, right here, I've got a design, you know, web designer. He's not going to write an XML interface. But if I say put these classes around this text, he can do that. I'm like, it's that simple. And, you know, these technical minds are more like, well, that just doesn't seem like you shouldn't, you know, this data, it's not going to be marked up in your web pages. That's just wrong. You need a back-end XML interface or something, or a SOAP interface, something that's going to do. I'm like, no. Okay. I said, have you worked at a corporation? Because if you go and ask permission to, you know, build this XML interface that you're going to design to get this data in and out, what are they going to say? They're not going to say go for it, most likely. There's going to be some sort of, tell me why we need this.
Right.
And if your web designer is marking up a page and spends another 5 or 10 minutes adding in a couple CSS classes that can then, you know, are templates for a system which then add HCards to 2,000 web pages, well, that's a win. That's why microformats are a win here.
Well, and more appropriately, it's time that they're going to spend anyway. You know, a good web designer is going to mm-hmm. think about their CSS hierarchy.
Right.
And by the way, that's one of the things we haven't done on the show yet, is we need to have a, you know, conversation about CSS for developers.
Yeah.
Because I think designers have really got it. And the nice thing is that we've pretty much worked out, you know, most of the kinks. You know, now CSS is CSS.
Right.
You know, IE6 aside. Well, that was 7 years ago. Okay, we apologized.
I still write pages that work in 6. I still test in 6,
yeah.
And they work usually.
Well, and that's the thing, is that most of your techniques, you know now.
Yeah.
You know how to get it to work. But we ought to have a CSS conversation for developers, because a lot of developers are mucking around in web pages.
Yeah.
And it's good to know that, you know, no, you don't have to have all that HTML. Just
right.
Stick with a couple simple tags and then defer to the CSS.
Right.
But, you know, the real powerful thing is that, you know, the microformat can be added just with CSS classes that you're going to add already.
Right.
I do think it's interesting that, you know, I think that the more proper way, you know, is web service calls to interchange mm-hmm. large amounts of data between companies.
Oh, yeah.
However, you know, you run into the thing that you mentioned, is that, you know, there are very few XML formats that are truly standard.
Right.
I really, I've, you know, proposed this to people before and they've freaked out that to me, RSS had more of an impact on anything than any web service technology. And there's been 3 or 4 good web service
Definitely.
Technologies,
right.
SOAP, REST, XML, RPC.
Yeah.
They're all good technologies, but they all rely on this chatter back and forth between the people saying, this is how I'm going to format the XML.
Right.
Whereas RSS is, man, you pick up the spec, you know what it is, you go for it. And that's why we've overloaded it so much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, you know, if you pick one of the acronyms, it's really simple syndication, which at the time, and again, back in the, you know, late 90s or whatever, or 2000, whenever it was, so many people didn't even have access to, say, a dynamic environment where they could run code. You know, they were publishing out their blogs as static pages. And
right.
When you had a system like that, you could just publish out a file that was an RSS file and put it on your site, and aggregators could read it. And so it was very low tech. And again, that's in a large part due to Dave Weiner, who is a high-tech/low-tech guy. You know, it's like, keep things somewhat simple so that they can spread. I mean, I'll openly admit here, I've written RSS parsers that, you know, I should say, I've written code that parses RSX as plain text, because
right.
There's been times that's been needed, and I could do it in about 10 lines. And that was the thing about RSS, is that you know, it was very easy for your typical hacker to say, God, I'm going to set aside an hour and write some code that's going to pull this RSS and do something with it. And, you know, he didn't have to get a bunch of SOAP libraries installed and, you know, get a server up and running or anything like that. So, again, just very simple technologies. And I think that's, you know, where microformats come in, too. It's just, to create it is very simple. And that's the whole idea. Creating it should be very simple. Consuming it should be somewhat simple, but you should be able to get complex if you need to.
Yeah. And again, you know, we'll have a bunch of frameworks coming to support these things.
Yeah, exactly.
It's inevitable.
Right.
I mean, honestly, I've been in technology for 17 years now. It always happens. You know, the frameworks will come along to make it, you know, make it accessible for everybody.
Yeah. And you know, the guys with the crazy ideas will come along and just write some nutty code that only they can figure out, but it'll demonstrate an idea. And maybe that'll get people interested and say, yeah, this is a great idea. You know, what can we build something, a framework, an application that's going to make it easier for everyone to do this? So
I think one of the things I believe this is that the time to start thinking about microformats for the average developers now.
Okay.
It's been, you know, this quiet underground thing for a while, but you know, it's something that's it's stuck.
Right.
We've got a lot of the standards worked out, you know, at this point, and it's definitely something we need. You know, we need that semantic piece, you know, of the web, and don't wait for some Web 3.0 stamp to come along.
Yeah. You know.
Any other final thoughts, Pete? I want to thank you for your time, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah, if you are a developer and, you know, you want to, you know, hopefully you've got a blog, because that's what developers should do nowadays, right? They should blog. And if you are still not quite sure how exactly to create a H-card or whatever, there's an H-card creator online. You can go there and plug in your name, phone number, whatever, and it'll kind of spit out the code you want. So yeah, that's a good starting point, I guess. Get an H-card up there and, keep listening to Larry. Check out microformats.org and, good luck to you.
Oh, one thing we didn't mention yet, the name of your blog.
Oh, well, that would be, Raster Web, and it is at rasterweb.net/raster. That's about it.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Pete.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.